This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's Fun Friday. My name is Jeff Sandhu. The only thing bigger than a pile of free tech on my desk, it's a pile of unwanted tech in my bin. Only joking. As is usual for a Fun Friday, Culture Pop's Matt Armitage isn't joking around. He wants you to take a long, hard look at yourself, and not because you're looking good. You want to waste our time with waste today. Is that right, Matt?
Hey, Jeff. Yeah, I was reading an article earlier this week. I think it was on Salon.com, and the journalist was in a small village in Yemen. Stay with me. It does start to make sense after a while. The writer remarked on how colorful the village was and that there were decorations hanging from all the trees, and that she was really surprised that there would be all these kind of festivities in the middle of a civil war. But then when she got closer to the village, she realized that the colors weren't coming from decorations, but actually from plastic bags. In the absence of any kind of functioning government services, all the discarded bags of rubbish had been whipped up by the wind and blown into the trees, and all the plastic was just hanging off the branches.
Right.
Of course, that's not directly what we're here to talk about today, or the fact that, you know, microplastics seem to be making their way into the food chains in the seas because fish find them tasty.
Yeah.
But I do want to talk about waste and how technology seems to be adding to it rather than preventing it.
So this isn't a climate change show?
No, although I think we are due an update on how that kind of technology is coming up with kind of potential methods to reduce the effects of the changing climate. We did touch on it a little during the Should We series, and it is something that I'd like to talk a bit more about, especially as we just discovered nearly 100 new volcanoes underneath Antarctica.
Yeah, I heard they put killer robots. They were put there by killer robots.
Yes, and Elon Musk, of course, was in the news again this week saying that artificial intelligence is more dangerous than North Korea. And I think that's because his, you know, the Boring Company may have stumbled on the robot's secret lair deep underground in one of these icy volcanic calderas. But he can't tell anyone because he's not supposed to be building the Hyperloop through the South Pole. Anyway, let's not stink up the studio with all this Musk. Let's stop wasting time and get to the waste of waste. Or to put it more kind of coherently, see, I can't even say coherently, we live in this very strange and counterintuitive world where we have all this really incredible technology, but we treat it all as disposable.
Mm. Are we going to be talking about the self-destruct chip that manufacturers sneakily put into everything we buy to make us buy new versions every couple of years?
That is one of the accusations that you hear kind of time and time again, right? People say, oh, in the good old days, you know, that mangle we used for wringing out the washing had been in the family for five generations.
And it still works.
Yeah, and back then things were built to last. And like a lot of these kind of stories and reminiscences, there is a grain of truth there. Household appliances, such as they were built for, you know, the long term, the duration. A mangle was built out of iron and it weighed roughly the same as a modern SUV. So, yes, it was built to last because that was the only way that you could build it. And the same, if you bought furniture, you would expect it to last you a lifetime. But that's also because good quality items were really, really expensive. If it took a carpenter a week to make a chair or a fortnight to make a table, then if you wanted a dining set for, you know, an average family size back then was like 10 people, it would cost you like 3 months of a carpenter's salary.
Yeah.
So in the good old days, people, or working people rather, rented their furniture. It was too expensive to buy. And of course, people tended to die a lot. Mass production of household items has kind of exchanged a measure of quality for affordability. But anyway, that's a kind of tangent because we were talking about the auto-destruct of consumer goods.
Yeah,
right?
So this destructive chip that they put in, is do you think it's a truth or a myth? Yeah,
I think it's basically a myth. I mean, it's certainly true that it's difficult to get a lot of the things we buy repaired now, but I think that's more of an issue to do with kind of consumer tastes and industrial design than it is a plot to defraud us. So, for example, our laptops, our phones, our tablets, they've shrunk because circuit boards are now printed onto the back of the screen to save space and to save energy and, of course, to save cost. And that makes it very difficult to replace individual parts. Anything goes wrong with any one of those, you have to change, you know, the whole screen and the whole motherboard and whatever. So you might as well just buy a new one. And also, we have to to remember that competition for a lot of these devices is actually, it's very high, and the margins are often very slim for manufacturers. So they really are looking at these kind of incredible volumes so that they can maintain profitability. And then, of course, repair services don't factor into that model because holding spare parts is inefficient. It takes up a lot of space. You don't use them very often. So it's better to make things so that they don't break in the first place. You know, when you think of something like the iPhone, it's a bit of an anomaly in the industry because it has a very high profit margin. A company like Samsung may make a kind of healthy margin on its flagship phones, but the bulk of its sales come from lower down the price and model scale, and the margins are very, very tight. And again, you know, in the olden days when electric goods were more kind of a local and regional affair rather than this kind of big global business, there probably were companies that had an eye on the quick turnaround and selling you something that would be replaced next year.
Yeah.
But now there's so much competition. Like I said, margins are slim. Customers are less likely to be brand loyal, so there's more incentive to build a quality product to maintain the kind of long-term health and financial position of your brand.
So why are we locked into these permanent replacement cycles?
I think this is where the story gets a little bit complicated. A lot of it is down to us, you know, purely it's pure and simple. We want new things. Partly it's fueled by advertising and the demands of companies to prod us to replace. And partly, of course, it's the speed and the advance of the technology itself.
Are we being manipulated?
It's complicated, as I said, so I'll break it down a little bit. Advertising, of course, can be very persuasive. A lot of the consulting work I do can be termed as within advertising.
You're the culprit then.
Well, I'm not exactly a white hat when it comes to this topic, but I don't think I'm a bad actor either. The public is not being forced to buy, but they are being heavily enticed. You know, there's a standard format for all the things we see. It's smaller, it's faster, it's cheaper, and of course, it's always better. But there's this kind of sneaking suspicion that a lot of manufacturers tease us when it comes to the product innovation side and the feature rollout so that we do get into this more regular upgrade cycle.
Isn't that simply about production obsolescence?
Well, we talk about obsolescence. You know, I need a new phone. Mm. My old one is obsolete. And I do know that most sensible people don't buy a top-of-the-line smartphone every year. I know, however, that people like you and people like me do. But when was the last time you actually bought a new phone because the last one broke?
Wow, never. It's been a while. It's been a long time.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the same for most people. And when I say broke, I mean, you know, in
can't
terms
use it
of
at all.
Yeah. It broke in terms of it wore out, not broke because you dropped it into the toilet bowl at a club for the 10th time and 3 days of drying it with rice doesn't resurrect it anymore. That's not the kind of broke I mean. You know, most of us, when we buy a new phone, we either sell the old one or we pass it on to a friend or a relative or an acquaintance. And I'm really guilty of this as well. We convince ourselves that we have to have the latest model with all the new functions. And I know you're really fond of new Samsung Galaxy.
Yeah.
I've got last year's model. It's a good phone. I'm not a big Android fan, as most people know, but it is a really good phone. Yeah. It's well made. It's got great design. It's well engineered. The battery life's okay. The camera's really good. It's responsive. But how different is your new one from that last model?
It's slightly better looking. It's got a better design. It's got a better battery-ish. It's got a better camera-ish.
That's it. All of those things are ish. And I can say exactly the same thing about my iPhone 7 Plus.
Yeah.
It's better than the 6S Plus I had last year. If I'm honest, the only thing that's really noticeably different is the camera.
Mm.
That is quite a big deal for me. I do take a lot of photos, but actually having the iPhone has made me a worse and lazier photographer because, you know, I don't value the photos so much and I just snap them. The leaked plans for the next iPhone, they show a corner-to-corner screen with a minimal bezel and probably an underscreen sensor, but that shouldn't be enough of a reason for millions of people to dump last year's or even the year before's phone to upgrade.
If it's working, why change in that sense? Well, but we will still change
it. It's not even that it's working. It's still the same. it's got a slightly better processor, a slightly better, but it's still the same.
Recycle and repeat. That's what we're talking about today with Culture Pop's Matt Armitage. We'll be right back with more BFM 89.9.
Before Friday materializes, BFM 89.9.
And we're back, Fun Friday with Matt Armitage from Culture Pop. Now, Matt, before the break, you talked about the speed of technology helping to push the idea of disposability.
Yeah, I'm going to stick with the phone, not because it's really the focus of all of this waste, but it's just the easiest
the most common example.
Yeah. If you go back 10 years, smartphones were rubbish. Yeah. You had to charge.
They were not smart.
No, exactly. You had to charge them every 2 minutes. And even then, the screens were so dim, you could only see them if you were in a pitch black cupboard. They were slow, and they worked on 2.5G and 3G connection speeds that were really, really painful. I mean, you could go back to your computer and answer an email while a website loaded up on your phone. It was not a lot of fun. So they were kind of gimmicky rather than the workhorse devices we have now. And it was by no means a foregone conclusion that the smartphone was going to be our future. We liked our dumb Nokias and Ericssons with their two-week battery life, their tiny size, and their really, really bad cameras because, you know, you could call, you could text, and maybe email. And how much more did you actually need?
Well, when you look at it like that, it's almost as though the first smartphones were a step backwards.
You might want to play a fanfare, Jeff. I have to admit, BlackBerry was more important to the development of smartphones in terms of getting people to adopt the new format than devices like the iPhone.
It's going to be heavy rain today. Matt Armitage saying BlackBerry
in a positive light, very crucial. You know, the first generation of smartphones was nowhere as good as the best PDAs that were on the market, like the Scions and the Sony Clio range, which were, you know, they were a lot more geared towards productivity and they were really good devices. But the smartphones started to progress very rapidly. You know, it was a new product segment. The hardware manufacturers saw the potential. They got to work making the chips, making the circuit boards that drove the development of the segment, and that allowed the manufacturers to push forward in terms of the software and go as, you know, as far and fast as they could. And as a result, we got used to all this upgrading. There were these kind of exponential improvements in the next model from 1 year to the next, but I think that's, you know, kind of over. Mm. Now the changes are a lot more incremental. We push up to the boundaries of the current generation of technology in terms of what the screens can do, what the batteries can do, but we still have this habit of renewing, and it's not just with our phones.
I think it's also down to iPhone. In 2007, it was the iPhone and Apple's marketing power that just got everyone into this bandwagon, and every manufacturer decided to.
I think so, and especially with the first Android phones as well, because the first Android phones were really rubbish. but they got better really, really quickly. Yeah, so people get into that idea of it's disposable. I need a new one. I need a better one. Or from the early phones, I actually need one that works.
Yeah. Are we seeing the same trend across the board?
We've talked about these examples so many times here. TVs are always my favorite example. It doesn't matter what you buy. As long as you stick to the major players, there really aren't any bad TVs. There are only slightly better ones. And the price hike for those little improvements can often be, you know, really steep. So when I buy a TV, I go to the hypermarket and I buy whatever is on special offer because it doesn't matter. The less complicated the TV, the better, because, you know, there are fewer things to go wrong. Yeah. There are fewer things not to upgrade. So just keep it simple. A friend of mine posted an old ZX81 computer for sale recently. The 81 means 1981 for some of our listeners who've never heard of it or weren't even born then.
That's me.
But that computer hadn't been plugged in for over 20 years, probably 30 years, but it still works. You know, you won't be posting to Facebook with it. You won't be editing family videos. But those early home computers were not put together to the highest of design standards or finishing. They were an evolution from projects that happened in people's garages. But the fact is that still works. after decades in a hot and humid Malaysian cupboard. So by and large, our technology is a lot more durable than our desire to keep on using it.
I feel a rant about 3D printing is coming on soon.
We will get there. The thing is, you know, so much of the tech we discard, the technology we discard, it ends up in a landfill somewhere. Now, we could do another story about the environmental damage, but I'm not going to go there today. We don't have to chuck all this stuff away. A lot of us do donate and recycle, but even the recycling hides a lot of problems. The devices are built in these shiny, dust and germ-free production rooms by automatons and humans who are acting like robots. At the tail end of its life, though, the tech is stripped down in very, very basic conditions. So China, for example, has had to clamp down on unlicensed recycling companies because they've turned entire villages and districts toxic. Computers, phones, anything you can think of, they're pulled apart by hand. The workers are often operating on piece rates. They don't have any basic safety gear or masks. And the bits with the precious metals, like the gold plate or nickel or whatever, are simply tossed into an old-fashioned smelter. Now, for those of you who were born in the post-blacksmith era, a smelter is basically a really, really hot furnace that turns metal into liquid and releases an awful lot of noxious fumes, which, you know, those fumes are not processed. So these kind of recycling plants are actually an environmental hazard in and of themselves.
Right. I know you have a solution here.
It's not my solution. And yes, there is a 3D printing additive manufacture link. You know, we need to move to this kind of position where our tech is a lot more modular, a lot more upgradable. You know, we all know you can tweak the performance of your car by buying an aftermarket chip. Partly that's because it's cheaper for car makers to use one engine for a lot of models and restrict the output accordingly. But you have a model there that's open to upgrading and modification. So we should be pressuring all manufacturers, not just car makers, to do similar things. I know Motorola is trying it with the Moto Z and its range of modular accessories. But at the moment, again, that seems more of a way to get you to pay for high-priced and chunky add-ons. I mean, the camera add-on for that just... You know,
it's like a phone
really
itself. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
It's the price of a phone.
So it's not really improving the utility of the phone, but it is a step on that kind of path.
And the 3D printing bit?
Well, in a world of 3D printing, you could actually, potentially anyway, you could recycle the old processors and the components and actually use them as the base for the next generation of your upgrades. You'd keep the mainframe, the box, but the functionality can evolve by changing all the kind of processory bits. So we're talking about kind of evolutionary principles rather than revolutionary ones here. You'd be paying LG or Sony for the license to make the upgraded parts. So the fee you pay to them is profit, pure profit to them after their R&D costs. They don't have to worry about manufacture or distribution or supply chain. You know, it's kind of a field of dreams for them. It's, you know, if they build it, you will come kind of thing.
Why do you think the big box manufacturers would be interested in selling upgrades rather than what they're doing now, selling completely new stuff?
Okay, this is purely my opinion. This is not market tested. This is based on observation.
It's all Matt's head.
Not in my head. It's on the internet. No, the stuff we already buy is generally of a very, very high quality. And oddly enough, that makes it harder for electronics companies to retain your custom. You can hop from LG to Samsung to Sony because the products are all equally good and there's very little to distinguish one from another. And I think that's part of the reason why we're seeing so many of these kind of... integrated home solutions that use these bespoke operating systems, because once you lock into that bespoke OS, you're less likely to choose another brand because it means you have to completely rebuild your home hub. You've got to change your mixer and your fridge and your cooker and your music streaming system. So you have all of these gadgets built into one brand, and it becomes no different from companies offering you these expensive coffee machines with pods. It's just at much higher stakes. Thing is, though, when consumers are looking at Internet of Things, they actually want openness rather than these lock-in systems. Yep. The Internet has taught us about integration and compatibility and this ability to move at will. People are not so interested in the kind of olden days format wars of VHS versus Betamax or Blu-ray and whatever it was that Blu-ray was fighting that nobody can even remember. You know, we want to turn something on, we want it to talk to everything else, and we want it to get on with its job, whether that job is heating your food or playing your tunes or selecting the best route for you to get to work.
So if manufacturers can build those closed systems to lock us in, why would they choose to build a modular system?
Closed systems are really expensive. Developing your own software, patching it, keeping consumers secure is very time-consuming and, like I said, really costly. You know, especially when you think of a company like Philips, which is a microwave maker, not a global security firm. And all of that expense has to be passed on to us as consumers when we actually buy these things. And that's an awful lot of effort to put in just to keep your consumers loyal. And the other thing is, when you look at that, it's not loyalty. You may buy into it initially, but there comes a point where you start to resent the power that one company has to influence your buying conditions. That doesn't really do your brand equity a lot of good because you're essentially turning your customers into not very willing slaves. If you move to a kind of more modular model, you don't change your base product. You're just upgrading it. So if you buy a Samsung fridge, you expect to keep it for 20 years or maybe more. Every time you upgrade, you're paying another fee to Samsung. They get a much longer revenue tail from you, and they don't have to worry so much about customers switching to other products and other manufacturers unless they have kind of hardware or software defects in their own product line. At the same time, like with the Android phones, the operating systems can become an industry standard. That way it's much easier and cheaper for everyone to maintain, for it to develop, and also to keep it secure. And it means that we can all have the latest tech we can take it to an advancement that we're happy with without actually discarding any of our own technology. So the functionality, the utility keeps moving forward, but the resource consumption reduces overall. And I think that's actually a happy ending.
Finally, for the first time, there is some conclusion into a topic. A fun Friday. It's a fun Friday.
Cool. Before I sign off, can I just mention that I will be at the Kuala Lumpur Festival this weekend. So if you want to see me live and live.
He's real.
I am real. On Saturday, I'll be on a panel for Digital Democracy, which is actually being hosted by BFM's Melissa Idris. The rest of the panel are proper people. They're like investigative journalists from Newsweek. They're global security experts. So come along and hear what they have to say. I feel like I'm the kind of token moron for that panel, to be honest. So that's at 1:30 on Saturday at the Black Box. On Sunday, you can see me at the White Box. So Black Box, wow. White Box. Right. Yeah, the two sides of Matt. Also at Publica for a discussion hosted by BMW on the Internet of Things and its adoption and its relevance to Malaysia. I'll be joining BMW Malaysia's head of corporate comms, Sashi Ambi, and IBM's CTO, Lee Yu Kit. Mm-hmm. So that should be a lot of fun as well. Loads of really cool stuff happening at Kuala Lumpur. Check out their website. You do have to pre-register for sessions, and you can do that, I think, at eventbrite.com.
Recycle and repeat. And finally, we have a happy ending with Culture Pop's Matt Armitage. We'll be right back with Geek Squawks after this, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.